Welcome to The Whole View. I'm Stacey Toth of RealEverything.com. I'm all about loving the skin you're in and being healthy inside and out.
And I'm Dr. Sarah Ballantyne of ThePaleoMom.com. I believe that scientific literacy is the key to improving public health. Welcome to episode 456 of The Whole View. As you may be able to tell already, today is opposite day, but it's not just a random opposite day. Today is, I think, a tremendous opportunity to tap into one of Stacey's many areas of expertise that do not overlap with mine and dive deep into the topic of foster care. As Stacey let me know, I had no idea when we talked about doing this show last week that it is Foster Care Awareness Month. And I've realized that even though I have actually a couple of friends, Stacey, you're not just the only one, who have become foster parents in the last couple of years, that I don't really know very much about the foster care system. So in an effort to increase awareness and education, I thought I would go on a wild ride with our listeners and we could do this together. And you can help educate us about this system and your experience as a foster parent.
Thank you. And I also hope to give insight into how it affects all of us, not just those who are participating actively as a foster family or someone in the system, but also what you can do if you want to be a part of it, but not necessarily ready to be, for example, a foster parent. So,
That's already one of my questions.
Right. So I hope that, you know, everyone listening will feel more educated after, but also informed on how they can take action if they want to, which is what we do here on the Paleo View. I told Sarah yesterday,
you just said the Paleo View. We haven't been the Paleo View in a while.
Wow. That is, I know, like 50 episodes ago. That's like a year ago. And I made that reference.
Over a year ago.
So this is what we do here on The Whole View. I am a little bit nervous, if I'm going to be honest. I never get nervous when we record because I'm never in the hot seat. But this week I have 14 pages of notes and I want to make sure that I'm doing justice to this. So first off, let me just say, here's a list of some famous people who were once in foster care. And maybe this will like help us all relate and get on the same page, because I think all of us are going to know most, if not all, of these people. So Eddie Murphy, Colin Kaepernick, Steve Jobs, John Lennon, Marilyn Monroe, James Dean, Willie Nelson, Ice-T, Louis Armstrong, Cher, and Alonzo Mourning, who's an athlete. For me, I hope that this is like already breaking misconceptions of foster care and foster kiddos, because I think one of the goals that I have with the show is to try to understand that neither foster parents nor biological parents who might have children in foster care are this stereotype to be demonized or to be thought of negatively. I will say one of the things that is like the main education that all foster parents get in training is that the goal is reunification. Reunification is what you call the ideal of having a child return to their biological family. And then sometimes that might not be the parent. So we're going to, whether I refer to it as caregiver or family or parent, just I'm going to try to be mindful, right? But it's not always the case that, when they return to family, that it would necessarily be the parent. And that might be by the parent's choice, or, you know, maybe grandma is helpful because their child, the parent, isn't ready or willing, or, you know what I mean? Like, whatever the case may be. So, but the goal is always to reunify with family, because they have found over and over again that that is where children do best long-term, is with family. So emotionally, mentally, all that kind of stuff. It's also Mental Health Awareness Month. And so, you know, to me, these things go hand in hand, and we're going to talk about some of that as we move through. But I wanted just to kind of like give a base level education of foster care so that we can bust through those misconceptions and then maybe move into more detailed information and education that I've had over the last year and a half in this process. So there are many different types of foster families. Many just go through the state directly. So I actually have a friend who just ended up adopting her foster daughter who went through this way. She didn't have an agency. Many people go through an agency because they provide administrative and emotional support to foster families as needed. So depending on where you live, all of this is, you know, a little bit different. The Department of Social Services, the way that it's run is state run. So it's not like it's a federal program that's universal. Many states operate a little bit differently from one another. So I'm giving obviously my own personal experience, which might be a little bit different in the state that you live in. But in general,
do the agencies then interact with the state on foster family's behalf?
Is that how that works? So my agency does helpful things for me, like finding medical providers who are covered under kiddo's plan because their plan is different than my plan. So I guess I'll just let me just back up for a minute. Then there's a third kind, which is what I'm in, which is a therapeutic foster care through an agency. Therapeutic foster care is a little bit different because we are uniquely approved to both foster and adopt because we had comprehensive, extensive training specifically around trauma. So most of the kiddos that come through a therapeutic foster care agency have experienced not just the trauma that would be associated with a foster kid. These are kids who've been significantly neglected or abused and have emotional and behavioral medical needs beyond what one might compare to their own biological children, if that makes sense. But it does. I mean, honestly, sorry. No, that's okay. Like, biological children can also have significant trauma. So I don't want to be like, it's so hot. I'm like, oh, I want to use my words carefully. But I think it's just important to identify, like, no matter what situation someone goes through, foster care in and of itself is trauma. You know, being removed from your home, living with strangers, the amount of like appointments and meetings and all these kinds of things really compound to the trauma, but it's also for these kids' safety to be reviewed. So we're going to talk about that in a minute. But to your point, Sarah, the therapeutic foster care agency that I go through, which is called UMFS in Virginia, they do the training and then the license, they like submit everything, right? They give me the forms, but then they submit and they track it down and they do everything with the state so that we can focus on being care providers to kiddos. That's the goal, is to like help with the administrative burden. And also there are times when I need emotional support because things are difficult. And so they're there for that. They're trained.
Oh, that's really neat.
Yeah. They're trained to be on the other side for me to call and be like, you know, like I need help or I need to vent or, you know, whatever it is. So for me personally, I wanted to go through an agency. I don't know really what the benefit would be through the state other than maybe the process might be more quick, more easy, training more limited. I'm not exactly sure. The process for us to be approved is another thing that I do want to talk about, which is that we went through months of training. We all foster families go through a home study. A home study means that someone comes in and interviews you, anyone else that lives in your home. They also interview your neighbors and people that you give references for. And we had our financials evaluated to make sure that we were stable, financially stable and not dependent on foster income. So all of those are there to ensure that when they're putting the life of a child in your hands, that you're not one of those cliches that's on a movie that's just doing it for the money and going to have them live in a closet. those horror stories are honestly so few and far between. I am in many, many, many fostering communities and different kinds of things. And there are stories that are, you know, sad about what a foster family might choose with their foster kiddo, like, you know, different kinds of things. But I have not heard, fortunately, to the kind of neglect that's typical in media, you know, movies and TVs and all that kind of stuff. Because where we are, the interview process would weed those people out. So,
one of the things that you mentioned was getting approved for both like fostering and adoption. Does that mean that some foster parents aren't like the way that they go through their training and everything ahead of time means that they can't actually adopt, like they can only foster? Is there what's the difference between these two different approval processes?
Yeah, it's interesting to me. I don't understand the mechanism of why states would decide this, but most states only approve either fostering or adoption. Fostering to adopt is something that in my state is only done through an agency like mine that has special privileges with the state because of the type of certifications and training that they give, and also that the kids that they work with are in need of consistency, right? Like it's better for someone who's been through extensive trauma to not go through what normally happens with a foster kid coming into your house. If you decide that you want to adopt that child, you actually have to have the child exit your home and be fostered by someone else while you start the adoption process. I don't know why.
So disruptive.
Yeah. So, and again, it's dependent on where you live and the type of certifications that you have. But one of the reasons that we chose our agency was because we had intended to foster, right? We had intended to be a family who got to meet and help lots of other families and benefit from what they bring into our life. Because one of the things that I wanted was to have my kids have more broad range of people that they meet and learn from and grow from and become better people from, just the same way that, you know, it's a mutual relationship, in my opinion. So not my opinion. It is a mutually beneficial relationship if that's the way you choose to take it on, right? But we also knew that if we found ourselves in a situation where we had a kiddo that could stay, that wanted to stay, that we wanted them to stay, that we were open to adoption. It wasn't like our goal going in. And so this was why we chose our specific agency that we would be approved to do both. So it's interesting to me. I did meet families who had gone through just like the state process, who had gone through that process, who had fostered, and then their kids needed to go to a different foster house while they went through the adoption process. And of course, that's an additional burden on the kids. So one of the things that I want to talk about is how many houses these foster kids usually go through the process, because the length of time that they stay in care, the goal is around 18 months. And on average, from the studies and statistics that people have, it's 1 to 2 years that they see kids in care. And so part of that is because there's always a plan that's written that defines the goal, and everybody in the treatment team. So the treatment team involves the family, the foster family, any care providers like therapeutic services, any medical doctors that are regularly seeing or giving input to the children, and of course social workers and agency workers or representatives. So my kiddo has a very broad treatment team that all provide input. Oh, and lawyers. And then, you know, there's this whole team. We'll walk through everybody's roles. They provide input into this plan. And the plan always targets reunification. That's always the starting goal. But that means that the parents need to do certain actions to meet that goal, to, right. you know, overcome whatever challenges they had that caused the state to be involved to begin with. So that takes time for everybody to work together to develop the plan and then to, you know, act within and make sure that everybody's hitting their targets and then all that kind of stuff. So when our current kiddo came into our care, we were told that it was estimated to be about a week because we anticipated that they would be returning. I'm sorry, that it would take about a year, not a week. my goodness. No, that it would take about a year because they had just entered care. And so we were working on the plan. And so, you know, there's a timeline for all of that. We currently have an all-time high for the demand for foster parents, and that plays into how long it takes for, you know, social workers and treatment teams and judges and everybody to provide input into all of this. As of September 30th, 2018, so the process takes 2 years for statistics to come in and to evaluate, right? So the last update was September 30th, 2018. There were 437,000 kids in foster care. Wow. I heard that number and I was like, wow, that's not as high as I would have thought, like, you know, percentage wise to the billions of population. But for perspective, that's every 2 minutes a kid is entering care. And that's currently in care. That doesn't count, you know, when someone leaves care and then re-enters, or, you know, how many were before or after, right? That's just currently in foster care. And so about one third of these are in relative homes. So what's great is the states try to prioritize what they call kinship care. So when they're looking to find someone to pair with a child when they enter care, they actually look for kin first. Right. So they ask
aunt or uncle, exactly. or grandparent, or
yes. So about a third of those are in relative placements, but almost half are in non-relative foster family homes. So 32% were in relative care. 46% were in non-relative foster family homes. What gets me is all the other percentages. So,
yeah, I was going to say, like, that doesn't equal 100. Like, where are the other kids?
So 6% are in institutions. That might be medical facilities. It also might be juvenile detention homes. And this gets me every time because these kids...
Wait, juvenile detention homes?
Well...
What is this thing?
Juvie, like, juvenile detention. Juvie, I don't know what you're going to
call it. As in, like, is it, you mean like in basically like prison for teenagers?
Right. But these kids haven't actually committed a crime. They just need a place to go. So in my state, when we started in November 2019, I think it was, there had just been an article written in the Washington Post, which is one of our local papers, but also a national paper, about how they had run out of places to put children, and they were starting to use juvenile detention centers as a holding spot for kids until they could find other places, but that oftentimes kids languished there for quite a while. So when we look at 6% in institutions, it doesn't define what that is in terms of, you know, sometimes if a kid is suicidal because of the trauma they've experienced, they might go to an institution for evaluation.
Right, which makes sense.
But usually that's a short-term stay, and then you're looking to put them in a safe, stable home long-term. So we don't know what the percentage is there in terms of how to break that apart from juvenile detention or medical. Then there's also trial home visits where the state actually retains supervision of the child, but is just more involved. That could also be in your state called wraparound services, which is essentially they're trying to prevent the kid from entering care fully, or for whatever reason, they're not approved the parent fully for the goal, but they feel that the child and the parent can be home on a trial basis, and the state would still have supervision of the child.
Right. Okay.
4% are in group homes. So
oh.
all of the kids that... Go ahead.
I was going to say... My mom, who has been on the show before, was a social worker before she was a teacher, and she used to work in a group home. And so, like, some of my earliest memories are of, like, meeting, because my mom would work, like, nights, and so we would go and, like, pick her up in the morning from the group home, and so, like, knowing the teenagers there. That's funny how in my brain I kind of had separated group homes from foster care, but of course it would be the same system.
It's interesting. Yeah. And I don't know how Canada does things, obviously, but, here the kids that I've had that have been in group homes went for medical type reasons. And that's where my agency works, to identify kids that have a trauma past that we can support. Because as you can imagine, staying in that kind of group home and being around other kids who've also had trauma can kind of, like, negativity can feed negativity. And then, you know, it can become less helpful. And you want, obviously, we want all kids to be able to grow and flourish and be their best selves. And so 4% in a group home is actually a lower number than I would have expected. And I think that's great. I think I just have a personal experience with the kiddos that I know, because I work in and I work with an agency that focuses on finding kids that are in those homes that would love to be in a safe, stable home.
Yeah.
And so anyway, the number that gets me is 1% have run away. So
that's 1 in 100.
Right. And so I'm like, oh, 1%, that's not that bad. But no, yes, 1 in 100, like, or
4,000 kids.
Exactly. So when you think about, these children have been through trauma, these children have experienced some sort of neglect or abuse to be in foster care to begin with, and then they are afraid, because of misconceptions with foster care, to go into a foster care house. Or maybe they have been in one and it wasn't a good experience for them, and so they run away and they kind of take their chances on the street. And that's where we, every year, to have 4,000 kids run away, that leads to some not great stuff we'll get into. But
it's just awful. That's, yes. I mean, it's really upsetting to think about.
Yes. I remember when I was in training, we tell stories without identifying kids' names so that we can understand kind of what to expect, right? And I remember the woman who was training said, we were talking about success stories, because, you know, you always worry about the worst case scenario. But I was like, tell me a success story. Tell me something positive. Yes. And she was like, well, I had a teenager who ran away, and both the teenager and the foster parent were open to returning to the home. And that was like her big win, her big success story. And I was like, what? Like, of course, if my kid ran away, like, of course I want them to come back. But the thing is that, you know, you don't have these long-standing relationships with the person whom is coming into your home, and building trust, especially when you've been through trauma, is really difficult. So it's hard for the kid to trust that you're not going to reject them, that you're not going to, you know, do harm to them, because that's the experience that they've had. And it's hard for the parent to not feel like, oh, you know, I've done something wrong. I'm not good at this, or, you know, what negative thoughts you might have if a kiddo runs away and you worry about what happens to them and you feel to blame for that. So being able to kind of get through your worst emotions and say, no, I want to help you feel safe, I want to help you feel secure, is a success. And I mean, I remember her telling me at the time, and I was like, that's not a win. Like, what are you telling me? But now I understand what she was saying. So, okay. So I would say, some of the other interesting statistics, I'm not going to walk through all of these, is that 56% had a goal of reunification with their caretaker. So I told you that's always the goal if it can be the goal. So when kids first come into care, that's the goal. And it might change over time. But 27% had a goal of adoption. So the goal is always like reunification with primary caregiver, reunification with other family. And then if you can't do that, you move to adoption, because we want kids to long-term be with one home instead of bouncing around in foster care. And then 49% of that 56%, not exactly right, because we're looking at year over year, but essentially 49% were reunited with parents or a primary caretaker. So I think that's huge to understand, like, the goal is always reunification. We're at 56% having a goal of that. And then in the same year, 49% of those kids were reunited with that primary caregiver. So this also includes, though, kids who are returned to their primary caregivers, but then re-enter. So that statistic is a little less lovely. I like to think of it as 49% go back to their primary caregivers. But a different statistic is that 25% of those who re-enter the system, so to speak, who have previously been in foster care.
So they go into foster care, whatever the sort of requirements are met to be reunited with family, they are reunited with family, and then something happens and they go back into foster care.
Right. So of those who are in foster care, 25% have re-entered the system. And wow. So when I say the system, I'm talking about either foster care or the juvenile justice system. So what that would mean, if we're looking at 25% who are there, it's a re-enter, that would mean about half of those who were reunited aren't staying home and are probably somewhat still experiencing trauma of some kind, whether the parent's making an effort. Sometimes it's hard to move past that as a kid, you know, and want to stay, or whatever the case may be. Mm-hmm. So they're re-entering as either in the foster care system or the juvenile justice system at 25%. And so the study that I found talked about previously, I think it was 10 years ago, it was 18%. So that's a 1/3% increase, which is not great. So
Are there statistics to kind of address, like, why that might have increased over time?
So the number one reason that kids are in care is drug addiction from parents. And oh. I would imagine
there's definitely statistics showing that, right, the opioid crisis,
yes,
that drug use has increased. Yeah.
And that would also be the case for relapsing, right? Like, the parent might be, so the, one of the documentaries that I watched, like, the kids and the parents get so much support when kid is in care, and they, you know, from therapy to all of these things, and, you know, addiction help, all this kind of stuff, services for the parents and services for the kids. And then once the kid goes back home, it's like, literally the book is closed and you're on your own. And if we had better transitional services, I don't think that we would see such a high return, right? If we, but there's nothing, the kid is no longer in control of the state. The state's no longer the guardian. So there's nothing that the state can really do. The parent is on their own to continue those services. And if you don't have healthcare, for example, to provide for therapeutic services and that kind of stuff, then it's difficult to continue that. Yeah. And I think the other thing to note is that through this process of entering, re-entering, all this kind of stuff, that on average, a child entering foster care will have more than 4 homes in their first year. And it's common for children who grow up in the system, so who, you know, are in the system for longer than a year, to move more than 15 times. And
wow.
I've had a kid who had that experience, so I can validate that. So imagine the trauma of leaving your family and everything you've ever known, and then moving 4 times in 1 year. And then if things don't go to plan, and I'm using quotation marks about the plan because there's a literal plan from the state, you might find yourself moving 15 times over the course of several years, and how difficult that would mean for your education and your mental health and general well-being. Like, it is so difficult, and then it's like compounded and onto these kids how much they have to go through and get over to be successful. I mean, it's heartbreaking for me. I've had 4 foster kids in my home in the last 18 months, and 3 of them had a goal of unification. Two of them are still on that path. One, their parent chose to terminate parental rights. So that's essentially saying this goal is not something that I think that I can achieve, or I think that my child would be better served if I were not the primary caregiver. It doesn't mean that you don't have a relationship with that child anymore. It's just saying I'm terminating my parental rights as the primary caregiver.
Yeah.
And that can be done by the state, or a parent can opt to do that. And then my 4th one had a goal of adoption, and that ended up not being their outcome. So every situation is unique, but the trauma of consistent rejection and abandonment, I have seen firsthand how that really compounds into challenges with, social interaction and mental health and all these kinds of things.
Is it when a foster kid sort of moves from one foster home to another? I'm sort of extrapolating. I imagine that there's all different ways that can end up happening, and all different people in the system who can end up making that decision, that it's not necessarily, always a, social worker who goes, this isn't cool, or foster parent who's always like, I don't like you.
Yeah.
Am I right in sort of that assumption that it is a sort of collection of really complex reasons that would have a kid move from one home to another?
Yes, absolutely. And also the kid can say they don't want to be there anymore. So,
everybody has to be happy with that placement.
Yes.
To continue.
Yes. Yeah. And, also when they come into care, it's really difficult to find someone who's just 100% available and ready, and that it's a perfect match and they're ready on day one, right? The state wants to like interview and evaluate, and, part of your home study is identifying things about your family. For example, are you religious? Do you go to church? Is the kid that you're taking on religious? Are they comfortable going to church? Because you can't force a child to do certain things when parental rights are in place. If the parent says, no, I'm Jewish, you can't take my child to Catholic school, then that family has to find some place where the kid can go, because the kid can't be left alone, right? It's like this whole thing. And so they have to look and find a home that's a good fit that will hopefully set them up for long-term success. So one of those first 4 homes is usually like a short-term placement. It's someone or a group home or someplace that's kind of, okay, the kid's in care until we find the right fit, hopefully in just a couple of days. That counts as a first placement, right? Like, that's the first place that the kid goes. And then
are there foster parents who kind of specialize in being that first stop?
I know our agency does a lot of that. There's also something called respite that you can train to become a foster parent and essentially sign up for short periods of time. And so this is one of the things that I would definitely recommend to people who are interested but not ready to commit long term, is you can train to become a foster parent, and you could be that person that takes someone in short term. You can also offer respite to families like mine who have a long term placement and for multiple reasons need or want a little bit of a break. And so it's a good reset. Like, I just went away to a hotel for Mother's Day and had a night by myself for a little bit of a break to rest and recharge, because we've talked about how, self-care needs are basic needs that we need to take care of ourselves, and especially if you're helping a traumatized foster kiddo, that's a big burden on your emotions and what is it? The separation makes the heart grow fonder. That's not exactly right. But so going, or maybe you need to travel to like a family funeral or some, you know what I mean? Like whatever it may be, and you need a respite from being a foster family. This is, we try to make sure that people know this is not a bad thing. This is not like a timeout. This is, you know what I mean? This is hopefully an experience that the kiddo can learn from and meet new people who can teach them about stability and caring and all that kind of thing. But people can sign up to just do respite. And so I have used respite before when I've had a long-term placement. I have also been respite when we did not have a long-term placement and a family, you know, had their kiddos come here for us to let them do whatever they needed to do for a few days. So that is something that can happen. And I don't know if that counts towards like moves because it's not a move, right? It's just like going to your friend's house for a sleepover or going to grandma's for a sleepover, whatever. I don't know. Did that answer your question?
That, yeah, absolutely. I'm wondering if you had a long-term placement and let's say there was like a, you know, you took a respite weekend every 3 months or something, is there an attempt to put the kid back in the same place for those respite weekends? Or is it like,
if possible, yes, yeah. If possible. So, like I said, I've been respite before and I was twice for the same kids because once you get to know someone, it's easy. And honestly, easy. Like my kids were excited. They were coming to play. You know what I mean? Like they came over, they came for a sleepover for the weekend. And so I think, you know, one of the challenges though, is this idea that when, so you have this hierarchy of needs, right? And it really depends mm-hmm. on where a kid is from a safety perspective as to how they would perceive and how well that would go. And so for me, it has always been kind of like, okay, well, let's be mindful of how we're using respite so that it is seen as a positive thing that is, you know, nurturing and developing kind of that love and belonging aspect versus feeling like it's a risk, it's a safety issue, it's concerning, it's you know, risking shelter.
Sure.
Do you know what I mean? Like you have, if someone doesn't kind of understand all those or aren't there themselves, then it's difficult for them to understand how that could be beneficial to them.
So bringing up Maslow's hierarchy of needs, which is a like phenomenal concept in psychology that dates back to Maslow's article in the 40s. Do you find that in foster, it's much more about sort of meeting those base needs? So for listeners who aren't familiar, this is a concept in psychology that certainly has been criticized and certainly attempts to measure it have shown that there's some blurry lines between the different levels and that there's a cultural impact and that there's an individual impact. But the idea basically is that there is a hierarchy, sort of like a pyramid sort of idea of basic human needs that are universal. So at the bottom of this pyramid, the most base needs that need to be met are the physiological needs, right? Air, water, food, shelter, sleep, clothing. Reproduction is put into this base because it's required for propagation of the species, right? So basic physiological needs. Then the next step is safety needs. So that is all the way from sort of personal security to financial security, basic health needs, you know, needs in terms of sort of resources. Sort of a really broad, a broad umbrella that is not just safety, but security. And then the next level is more socio-emotional. So it's love, it's a feeling of belonging, it's friendship, it's intimate relationships, it's family relationships, it's social connection. The next level of the pyramid is considered esteem. So it is things like self-esteem, but also the feeling of being respected, the feeling of being recognized, the feeling of having a social status, freedom. So it is, these are like the four levels that are all sort of considered needs that you strive for. So if you have a deficiency in any one of these, you have this psychological drive to achieve it. And then the top of the pyramid is called self-actualization, which basically means that you you have met your full potential. You have, you know, you have become the best that you can be, and that the Maslow basically postulated that you can't get to self-actualization until all of these other sort of more basic human needs are met. And that self-actualization is a little bit different from the other four levels of his hierarchy of needs, in that if you have a deficiency in self-actualization, when you progress towards it, so if you have a deficiency in, say, food, as you get food to eat, your drive to get food goes down. So in these, the bottom four levels, your drive to get the thing that you might have a deficiency in decreases as you get that thing. And self-actualization is reverse. So the more you self-actualize, the more your drive is to continue self-actualization. But the whole idea behind this concept is that you basically, you can't be your best. You can't fulfill your sort of best self. You can't develop into the person that you're meant to be. You can't achieve your goals in a really broad way until all of those base physiological needs, safety needs, belonging needs, and esteem needs are met. So my question for you, Stacey, with that psychology tangent, who knew, is do you think that foster care, my guess is that it's much more about addressing deficiencies in the base hierarchy needs.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the things that I say often that might be interesting for people is, so traditionally it is the case that foster kids struggle with school, right? Like whether they even want to go or how well they perform. And one of the things that I often say is, you can't worry about math if your safety needs aren't met, right? And so if you're thinking about it from that hierarchy, this pyramid, right? Like if you physically are concerned about your shelter, if you are concerned that you don't have food, if you don't have an attachment or a sense of security with feeling loved and feeling like you belong somewhere, which is a struggle that a lot of foster kids feel after this rejection from their own family is what it feels like, then there's no way that you can think highly of yourself in terms of self-respect, self-love. None, those are like literally a foreign language. Like you can't get there, and you can't worry about getting A's in math. Those are things that are part of esteem and self-actualization that literally cannot, the brain does not work the way that the amygdala functions is one of the trainings that we extensively go through, because if there's trauma, it shuts down and doesn't allow you to focus on any of the other areas until it's kind of like protected itself from these basic needs. And attachment and safety and shelter are the ones that come up over and over again, because I will say, even, you know, when we have a kiddo here, and where we might know our intentions and we might know that, you know, we're providing love and support and safety and all these things, to them, they have experienced being ripped from what they thought was safe in that situation before. And so it's like, it's always looming, like it's going to happen again. I can't I can't let my guard down. It's
so hard to trust.
Yes, exactly.
In that situation.
So even though they have shelter and safety, it doesn't feel like it's permanent because of the experiences that they've had previously. So I do want to talk about the team of people who come together to help kiddo understand all of that, right? Because it's not only on me to give guidance, fortunately, thank goodness, to give guidance on all of those things. And also, I think there's validation when you hear from another person, like, you know, Stacy and the family are committed to, you know, whatever, right? Like, it's one thing if I say it's another, if other third parties are able to kind of validate that. So, the first one that I want to mention is ACASA. So this is a court-appointed special advocate that is a volunteer position whose sole job it is to advocate for the child's best
interest. What does CASA stand for?
Court-appointed special assistant, I think. Yeah. I said it. No?
Yeah.
Okay.
maybe I missed it. Yeah. Okay.
Court appointed special advocate. And what it is it just means they are the advocate for the child. They volunteer to spend time with the kid, whether that's virtual or in person, and hear directly from them what is going well, what is not going well, what they want or what they don't want. And the CASA advocates to the judge, especially, but the rest of the treatment team as needed for that kid. And the CASA would also be someone who, you know, would be able to say, I think, depending on how much time they're spending with the kid and what the kid is saying, you know, I think that they need additional support in these sort of areas, right? For me, my CASA doesn't do so much of that because we have a larger team from the therapeutic foster care side, but for cases where it's just going through the state, that CASA can play a really critical and beneficial role to the best interests of the child. And because it's a volunteer position, it is something that you can do, that anybody can do, if you want to support the system. So I know people often ask me, what can I do if I, you know, want to help and be a part of this? This is an easy way to enter that without, you know, having someone come into your home. You can provide this role. The CASA works really closely with the GAL, which is the guardian ad litem. They're a legal advisor. They're a lawyer to the judge about what kiddo wants. So not all kids have both a GAL and a CASA. I've had kids that had one but not the other, and I've had kids that have had both. The GAL participates kind of like the CASA in listening to the kid and the treatment team in general, and then providing color to the judge about, you know, how the kid is doing and what the kid wants. So, you know, this would be where if, for example, parents were getting wraparound services, the GAL could say, you know, the kid hasn't been attending school or doing well in school. I think that this is difficult on them. Or vice versa, they could say, you know, I've seen great improvement from where we were previously. I think we need to continue to support and see how this goes, right? Like they're providing that advice to the judge based on what they're seeing, because the judge is only getting some pieces of paper every couple of months, and they need people to tell them like how it's actually going. And those two people from the state can provide that input. Then there's lawyers. They don't get involved in the day-to-day, but they, of course, are there for court cases, and they reach out as needed. Both kiddo and the biological family have their own court-appointed lawyers. So they're actually represented by different people because of interests, conflict of interest, and that kind of stuff. Right. The DSS worker works with both kiddo and the family, or just one as needed, depending on what the goals are. This person is the legal guardian for kids. So when my kiddo signed up for school, this is the person who signs the forms. Like this person is the literal guardian. As a foster care person, you have rights to, like, you know, sign a field trip form, but not like signing someone up, like medical forms and different sort of things that are like formal paperwork. This would be that person. And this person is also someone who hopefully both kid and foster care and biological family all have a relationship with and can talk to and can be kind of like a mediator as needed. Like, this is the person that when you're not going through an agency is really the person who you lean on. And unfortunately, the social services worker is, you know, understaffed, underpaid, and overworked. They have such a high caseload that I've worked in multiple different counties, just the way that the agency that I work with functions. And I worked with one county that was a lower income county. So the social services worker caseload was higher because they had less funding. And that person was never available. That, I mean, they were a lovely person. When we got a hold of them, they wanted to help as much as possible. But they were so overwhelmed with the amount of workload that they had that there's no possible way that the kiddo could have been set up for success without the additional treatment providers that I had. So I often kind of take myself back to, is that is what most people are experiencing in the foster care system. And it's why, you know, we often end up with issues and bad stories in the system, because if you're not being supported, and this is such a traumatic time, as we just talked about, it's difficult to be set up for success, right? Like, you need to have a social services or other therapeutic care workers involved. So that is one of the benefits that I have, is that I have additional treatment providers because of the kind of care that I'm responsible for. Those include like the wraparound services that I mentioned, also intensive in-home treatment therapeutic services. So a lot of people don't know this is available. It is available to you as well if your kiddo needs help. So for example, someone with a high level of trauma or emotional or mental health needs, for example, suicidal ideations or, you know, different kinds of self-harm or just really, you know, significant PTSD or trauma, this person would actually come into the home dependent on how often was necessary and provide normalized therapeutic services. So what I mean by that is you walk around the neighborhood and you're just chatting about how your day was or your week was, and then you're able to kind of process some things with this person, because when you're not at that self-actualization level, you might not recognize that you were triggered by something. And so this person is able to kind of say, okay, well, let's talk about what that might mean. I've had this person with kiddos that I've had do art with the kid, you know, go out into society with the kid to see how they act, you know, in public, like going to the store. I've had this person play games or just sit and read sometimes if the kid is like not open, but giving them that space to just still be with the person. And sometimes, you know, it takes a significant amount of time before someone's willing to open up, right? So this person usually comes for several hours at a time so that it's not like therapy, which is also available, where you show up for like 45 minutes and you jump in or not, you know? And so if right. The only thing that kiddo was getting was that kind of therapy, it would be really difficult for them to fully process everything if they're at such a base level of need in terms of like safety, security, attachment, and that kind of stuff. So normally, like, my in-home therapeutic service person talks to the therapeutic person to talk about, okay, we were able to parse out this, this, and this for you to try to talk to them in therapy. But I mean, I find that the kids that I've had are completely like not willing and open to talk in like that short therapy session, but that they respond really well to the in-home therapeutic services, which makes sense, right? Like, yeah, you think about play therapy and different kinds of things in a safe environment for them, people are more willing to kind of like let their guard down a little bit. So, okay. And then lastly, I also have a therapeutic foster care worker, which is essentially like a social services worker. They are trained the same way, but they work for the agency and they work in tandem with that DSS worker with the state. So this person does even more paperwork for me, or I'll explain to them what my needs are. Like this person, I check in with them and I'm able to call and be emotional with them. And then they take care of connecting to like the CASA and the gal and the DSS worker. Like, so it's less of a burden on me and I can just focus on kiddo. And then of course there's all the medical professionals and doctors for things like med management and blah, blah, blah.
And are all of these different, I mean, this is an entire team of people who are, have different roles in terms of basically making sure that the best possible outcome is achieved. Are they all consistent through, you know, even if that kiddo goes to a few different foster homes, this, you know, group of people are all the same person, that they're, you know, they're always talking to the same gal or the same CASA, no matter which foster home they're in?
I have not had consistency in any of the kiddos that I've worked with. Mm. It's interesting. Children with one consistent caseworker have a 75% chance of permanent placement, and those with two drop to 17%.
Whoa.
That is huge, right? Those with three or more caseworkers have a 0.1% chance of placement. So when we look at caseload and how overwhelmed someone feels, you're more likely to expect that person to leave their job, right?
Right.
And the impact that that has on the outcome of the child. I mean, we're not going to blame a social worker because they're overwhelmed and they leave their job, but that lack of consistency to be able to articulate the kid's needs. And also, this is a person who is the legal guardian for kiddo. Their kiddo is trying to make a connection with this person. So if kiddo feels abandoned by yet another caregiver,
yeah,
that makes it that much more difficult for kiddo to be successful. So, like I said, I work specifically with the kids with the most support needs. And so, of course, it's not unsurprising that my kiddos would have had multiple caseworkers. But, you know, one of the kiddos that I worked with had been in the system for 4 years, so you might expect that. But the other had been less than a year and has already had two caseworkers. So it's just how it goes, I guess. The other interesting factor for me is this med management piece, because it's not something I really kind of understood coming into foster care. And there was a lot of training around medicine. And I'm like, what medicines are these kids on? But all the kids that I've had have been on medicine. And the rate of psychotropic medication in particular, the use for youth in foster care, is as high as 52%, wow, compared to 4% of youth in the general population. So this is compounded, of course, by the fact that we're over-medicating from under-supporting therapeutic services, because not all kids are getting the level of care that I just talked about.
Right.
But also because trauma begets more trauma. And by simply being in the foster care system and by having experienced the neglect or whatever it was that these kids experienced in their own home, they're working through the need for more medication because of that. So it's one of the things that I'm recently looking into is how we can support as people, the system in general, to be better so that we're reducing the incidence of, you know, inconsistent caseworkers and the impact that that has in kids, or, you know, reducing the amount of medication that is really difficult on these little young growing bodies by providing more therapeutic services, you know, like, I don't know that a normal, I'm saying normal, a foster kid entering through the state versus through kind of a therapeutic agency would be getting intensive in-home, for example. And you just heard me describe how beneficial that is for, for my kids, right? So the need for medication goes down when you're able to process your trauma and work through those things, right? And so I think for me, it's become a passion, like, what can I do to support the system that has become a burden? And some of the things that have really led into the system being so overwhelmed is COVID, COVID has had a significant impact. Yeah. We haven't, you heard me talk about the numbers for 2018. They're expecting much, much significant increase because of the impact COVID has had. But also, what other things can we do to support the system so that it's not so overwhelmed and in general? So I don't know, Sarah, do you have kind of like thoughts on the impact that the virus has had? I mean, we've done so much to research all of that and the, you know.
Well, yeah, I've seen a couple of news articles that have sort of summarized how sort of multifactorial the impact of COVID has been on the foster care system. So everything from, you know, turning visits with part of the team that would normally be in person to like at the door and trying to establish if a kid is being abused from that kind of distance or even over Zoom, how there are, you know, foster families who don't want to foster now over fear that the kid would bring COVID into the home. And the backlog of cases, I was reading this the other day, the backlog of cases in the court system has meant that the priority has been taking kids out of dangerous situations, so removing kids from families, and then all of the different meetings that would go with like reunification are the ones that have been postponed. So there's more kids entering the system, and then reunifications that could be happening are not, just because of the backlog. And that's just like my super surface understanding of how COVID is impacting the system, that it's like at all of these different points. You've mentioned to me that you've had meetings that would have normally been in person become like teleconference type meetings.
Yeah. I mean, from court cases themselves to the check-ins that we do. So one of the things that foster parents are required to do with certain members of the treatment team, depending on who's on your team, is to have regular check-ins. So I have a weekly check-in with my therapeutic foster care worker that the foster care worker is required to physically see the child once a week, but that's being done via Zoom. And so I think it's a lot more difficult too when it comes to placement, because I remember, especially early on, how difficult navigating the system. I mean, once they were a year in for our current kiddos placement, they had things kind of under control. But in the beginning, they had to ask you if you were willing to take on the risk of not knowing if a child had been exposed or what their circumstances had been in, because when someone comes into care, you don't know. And just kind of being like, okay, well, quarantine them for a while. Well, you just have a new kid in your house. You're not going to be like, go stay downstairs.
You're supposed to be establishing
trust and relationship.
And a feeling of belonging.
Yes, exactly.
And how do you do that with, but don't leave your room.
Yes. So by the time our current kiddo came in, they had testing, which they didn't have in the beginning, and all this kind of stuff. So kiddo was required to be screened and have a negative test before they entered our home. And so then we were able to have much more normalcy of just, you know, welcome, hang out, all that kind of stuff. But I think the impact of, you know, everything going virtual also has an impact on the reduced number of times that social workers are checking in on things and what impact that could have for continued trauma in homes. You know, like if you're not physically walking around a home, what are you missing if you're just like Zooming with and only seeing someone's face and those kinds of things. And so, you know, it has been an incredible burden to the system. And now that people are kind of understanding how to act in it more. For me, I'm having all of my regular visits become in person now. And my DSS worker, who never had regular visits with me, part of that is because she checks in with my therapeutic worker, but she's going to start doing visits in person now, but wasn't doing virtual visits, you know? So it's like, it's the protection for the child to have these people come in and check and make sure things are going well.
And relationship building too. I would imagine that it's so much harder to build trust when you only see someone's face on a screen compared to they came out here to check on me and we are in the same room.
Yeah, it's a great point. And because they are advocates and connected to the kid. So even if kid were to leave my home, hopefully they would have the same caseworker. And so that consistency and that bond would be tight. And I think what's also I want to point out is that all of these examples that I'm giving and all of these treatment teams and the ability to Zoom and all this kind of stuff is all very much dependent on the privilege that I have to live in the area that I live in, to live in a county with significant funding for these roles in these programs. And it is much more likely to be the case with white families that they have that kind of support. I was shocked to hear that 53% of Black children in the United States will be investigated as potential victims of abuse. So let me say that again. 53% of Black children in the United States will be investigated for potential victims of abuse. That means every other Black child that you meet will have been investigated, though...
Presumably, I am going to make the assumption that that is systemic racism.
Yes,
at play, yes. Not actually a dramatic increase in actual abuse.
Right. So, leading the witness here, that's a 16% higher rate for all children. And what they found is that Black children were actually less likely to need to be in foster care. So those investigations weren't productive because of the 437,000 kids in care, 44% were white and 23% were Black.
So that is a lower percentage of Black children in the foster care system than the population of America that is Black, which means that if nearly or more than half of that of Black children are being investigated as potential victims of abuse, that the vast majority of that is again systemic racism, not necessarily individual racism. I want to be clear. So
to kind of quantify that, Black children accounted for 23% of the children in foster care, although they only make up 14% of the country's makeup. But then when you look at overall, you've got a lower number as it relates to the percent that are white. So it's this. This alarming when you investigate more and when you assume the worst. Because of systemic racism.
You're pulling kids out of families that they don't need to be pulled out of families.
And where the state will make every effort to reunify or wrap around services or prevent the removal of children, we see that a lot more in affluent or white areas. So
is that in part related to funding?
I think so. I don't have statistics on that, but... when I look at cases, for example, of Makai Bryant, who was the Black foster teen fatally shot earlier this year, I wonder, had she had significant support services and a treatment team like my kiddos have been given, would she have called the police for the concern that she had, which then escalated? Or would she have had the ability to call her treatment team for that emotional support and been able to de-escalate the situation? That situation was tragic, and I don't want to get into it, like, you know, to parse it apart because I don't have all the facts. I'm not, you know, an investigator. But what I can say is that the kiddos that I have, if they had concerns or and they have many times, they have an entire team of people that they call. Like they know that if they're frustrated with us, they don't like that we tell them no for whatever reason, like most kids don't like when their parents tell them, that they can call, and they do call, their social worker or their treatment team worker or their in-home therapist is the one that, you know, is most often called to help process. Because when you're coming from a place of trauma and all those like heightened emotions that we just talked about, you do not have the ability to calm yourself, to have that sense of self that we were talking about, to regulate and cope in a healthy way. You don't have those mechanisms if you're still worried about safety, security, and all those things. And so that's how a situation gets so quickly escalated if a support team isn't there. So do I know for a fact what, you know, someone's treatment team is or what support they have? Absolutely not. But I do know that because all of these roles are state dependent and, you know, funded through those mechanisms, depending on which area you live in, that would be the assumption I would make. Yes.
We've got my little injustice radar is definitely like on because it just to me it feels like something that we really need to build awareness about the systemically different way that Black children are treated through the system. You also have in your notes here that Black youth are 5 times more likely than white youth to be committed to a juvenile justice facility, which, again, this is complex and there's obviously lots of different things that go into that statistic. But when you consider how important, right, the having one care worker is, having having a worker who doesn't have a caseload that is so crazy so they can actually be present and available for the child, and so how important funding is into this entire system, you know, it really, to me, it sort of illuminates the need for more funding, and also the need to sort of address the different inputs into this, right? Whether it's implicit bias, whether it's funding, right? Like there's obviously a lot of different things that go into those types of statistics, but like that's got to be fixed.
Yeah, I think, you know, another example of that is the tragedy of Cornelius Frederick, who was restrained and killed. He was a 16-year-old Black boy. He was in a for-profit foster care group home facility. So just like the prison system, some of these facilities can be nonprofit or for-profit. And in this particular instance, he passed out from being restrained and reportedly yelled, "I can't breathe," before he was killed. You know, it's these kinds of instances that I can't breathe. Like I can't like process that. It breaks my heart to know that like these kids are victims. And one of the things that we learn in training is that behavior is a driver of emotions, right? And in these cases, all of these kids have experienced such trauma, such abuse in their own lives that their behavior is a reflection of that. And when we act from a place of defense, it becomes escalated and problematic. But if we can get on the front of it with offense and we can try to support and treat the emotional aspect of it, then we see less of the behavior on the back end. So, I mean, we see this in a simple, not simple, right? But like in more statistics outside of these that you might think of for your own family, like 3% of youth in foster care graduate from college. Only 3%. And that's because when you look at, you know, the prioritizations of the emotions and the support that they're given, what they are taught is important, or how they see themselves, their own sense of self-worth or their ability. It's not something that is felt to be achievable, right? And on the flip side of that, 25% are incarcerated within 2 years. So one of the main problems that we have in this country is that children age out of care with no support. So they're in care, they might be in a group home, whatever it is. And when they turn 18, it's the boot with no support. And it's really difficult to set yourself up for success when you have absolutely no support system, when you don't have a parent or a grandma or someone to call to help you when you have needs. I don't know how many times I called my parents, and I'm a super independent, refuses to ask for help type person, right? And yet I needed to do laundry at my grandma's house, and I needed my dad to float me some cash sometimes, or you know what I mean, whatever it may be. And so when we look at things like the trauma that they've experienced, you know, another thing to consider is these children, and adolescents with foster care experience are diagnosed with PTSD at twice the rate of U.S. war veterans. And we're doing great things to support our veterans. We could do way better, right? But we have the VA. We have dedicated resources and support for veterans who have had that trauma, and we've become more aware of needing to do more and to do better for that support. Yet here we are with children who have diagnosed PTSD twice the rate of veterans, and there is zero support for them when they turn 18. So, you know, it's not surprising that within years of aging out of the system, 50% of them have no income, which leads to not having a home, not having a job, which is linked to increased risk of drug addiction, increased risk of unwanted pregnancy, and trafficking. And so I do just want to like also put some information about trafficking out there, because I think we have a lot of misconceptions. Let me find the exact statistic here. I think it's 60% of those who are trafficked have a history in the child welfare system. That is just mind-blowing to me. So 60%, so I'm going to say that again, because it was a statistic that like blew me away the first time I heard it, and really put a lot of perspective on why we have a problem, like why we have a problem and why we need to solve it, right? 60% of the domestic child trafficking victims have a history in the child welfare system. The average age of those victims is 15, and 91% of missing kids that were reported, now remember, throwing back to 4,000 runaways, right? So 91% of the missing kids that were reported were running away from home or from foster care. So I'm just like, why aren't we helping these kids more? Especially because these rates of missing children were significantly abducted or trafficked by family members. Less than 1% is attributed to non-family or stranger abductions. Yeah. So we've got 99% of these missing kids being put in situations of extreme danger. And we know that they're coming from running away from difficult home situations and having been a part of the system, yet the system isn't helping them enough to prevent them from going into these dangerous situations. Like, to know that 60% of them had been through the system, like we could prevent it. You know what I mean? If we were doing a better job, we could take those 60% out of being trafficked if we were supporting them better. And so it's just, I cannot tell you how much it breaks my heart, and to know that it's preventable and we need to kind of work on it more.
I want to interrupt for briefly to, I'm hoping like consolidate a couple of these big concepts, because I think we started off the show really talking about, the positives of the foster care system and the way it's set up and the support structures that are put in place for these kids. And I think talking about some of these more alarming statistics, like to me, I think that the big theme that this reveals is that the system is underfunded. You know, there's obviously a need for more expertise, for more volunteers, and just for more awareness so that people can be supportive people even in an unofficial capacity. If you're, you know, your kid has a friend at school who's in the foster care system, what can you do to, you know, create a feeling of societal connection and belonging for that kid, right? There's a lot of, I think, ways that just increasing that education and awareness can sort of percolate and be really helpful. But I kind of just want to, you know, for me, like the big thing that the big thing that I see you saying through all of these statistics is there needs to be more funding. There needs to be some ongoing support after these kiddos turn 18. There needs to be ongoing support after reunification, right? There's these obvious places to add services that could dramatically improve the outcomes.
Absolutely. You know, I think how different could those numbers be if we had all the treatment team workers that I described, if they were all there? And, you know, one of the things you heard me say was in some of the cases we had a CASA, but not a GAL or vice versa. Right. And not everybody has a therapeutic treatment team worker like I have. And I had a case where the social services worker was rarely available. Right. So it's like, yes, that treatment team exists and it is intended to be supportive, but when the people are overworked, it is impossible for them to provide the support that is intended with that system, right? So I think the other thing that I want to highlight and I feel is very important is that a lot of kids end up in care because of abuse or rejection from their families. So we've talked about neglect or this idea that the family would want to reunify. And a lot of cases that is significant. But one of the statistics that is hard for me is that 30% of youth in the foster care system identify as LGBTQ and 5% are transgender compared to 11% and 1% respectively not in foster care. So kind of like we're looking at systemic racism as an issue, we're also looking at
systemic discrimination as well. Mm-hmm. But also I mean, that does that reflect a cultural challenge where, you know, families don't know how to respect a kid's identity?
Yeah, I think that's a good way to describe it. And we also see that about 40% of youth who identify as LGBTQ are, I don't have the right word. You always say it correctly, are without a home, right? Those
unhoused,
those youths who are unhoused, 40% of them identify as LGBTQ. And again, 11% is the general population number. So we're seeing that a significant amount of kids are not feeling respected or supported at home and are either running away without another place to go or ending up in foster care at a much higher rate, which is very sad. So I will say, you know, without the safe care of proper foster care placements, right? You heard me say one of the things they try to do is find a family that is a good fit. It's not a perfect world. It doesn't always happen, right? And so these kids sometimes suffer more acts of violence and different sort of things in the foster care homes that they go to as well, which is where you get more runaways and that kind of stuff. And so it is tragic what is happening in the system to support youth and also the families. I also want to say that sometimes the biological family can be trying and doing everything that they can, but either because COVID, they lost their jobs and they no longer have a home, or they no longer have resources to provide, you know, food, shelter, and safety for their kids, or maybe because they have an opioid addiction that is difficult to break, especially when you don't have, you know, a support system to help you do that, then, you know, they're losing their children and the additional burden that that puts on the system. So one of the ways that I am currently focusing on trying to solve the problem is I'm personally donating to organizations that are trying to make systemic change, that are trying to improve the system so that we have less of these issues and can play offense instead of defense.
Can you share some of those organizations?
Yes. So currently I'm doing a fundraiser. I did a fundraiser for Children's Rights Organization. This was a new one that I found this year that I've become. Almost all the statistics that I found today, not all of them, about half of them, come from the work that the Children's Rights Organization do. And they focus a lot on individual court cases in states to improve the requirements that the state has to meet the needs of children. So if you go to their website, you can see, I think it was like 11 or 13 states that they've operated in. And for every dollar that's donated, it equates to $100 being put into the system because they're working on systemic change. And so it compounds over time if we can get resources and requirements put in for the system itself. You can donate or you can sign up for a membership to Children's Rights. I think that would be a great gift to give someone, right? Like I've given you this. There's also other organizations like Together We Rise, which is another nonprofit.
Mm-hmm. I've heard of that one.
And they do this cool thing called a birthday box where you can donate, like on someone else's birthday, you can give a birthday box to a kid in care so that, you know, they have a gift on their birthday. And I also really like Dreammakers Project, which is run by America's Kids Belong. So the Dreammakers Project, you can support individual foster kiddos who are aging out, who have basic needs. So things like bus money to get to their job or money to get a computer so that they can finish school. But you can also support the Dreammakers Project shop, which is super cool. It's where kiddos that, either were or are in care are making goods that you can purchase. It's kind of like an Etsy, but for foster kiddos. And so I've personally bought like cards that people made that are like artwork cards, drawings, you know, that someone then prints and publishes to be on cards. And also they have some spices that I gifted. So you can shop on the Dreammakers Project shop, and we'll put links to all of those in the show notes. I will also say that you can support specific agencies. So like mine local, the one that I go through is UMFS, to support things like additional therapeutic foster treatment workers are funded mostly through grants and donations through these nonprofit but private organizations. So you can find one in your local area. You can also donate goods like suitcases and car seats that you might have or that you want to purchase instead of money to give these organizations so they can put more towards salaries and less towards items that kids need when they come into care. And then you can also shop Beauty Counter with me because this month I'm donating 20% of my proceeds to these organizations. I already did Children's Rights last month. I raised $2,500 for them. So I think this month I'm going to be focused more on the Dreammakers Project type things because I love supporting individual kids and hearing from them. Like when you support one of these projects, you get an email back from the kid who tells you what they did when you supported their particular basic need, which is cool. Mm-hmm. So I just want to encourage everyone to talk honestly and openly about what all of this is. I think there's really great things, like you said, Sarah, that the system intends and that can come when, you know, the best of intentions are there. I think there's a lot of misconceptions and myths and, you know, all these kinds of things. And the problem is that I've seen is that those don't come from, you know, an ill-intended foster parent trying to abuse the system for, you know, the support money that they get, which, by the way, is not enough to like live off of. Like, it's not right. It's that it would surprise me.
If you had 20 foster kids.
Yeah, and you can't, right? Because you have to have a certain number of bedrooms and, you know, like all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And you can't have, you know, people sleeping in the same room together. So it would be very difficult to do, like unless they're siblings or unless they're same sex, like you can't, you know, have them in the same room. But talking honestly about what you hear and knowing that, you know, I'm a good person with good intentions and I'm doing this, I hope gives comfort and confidence to people about the system in general. And also knowing that the misconceptions are really about the frustrating aspects of this that we could do better are things that we can make changes in the system, not about like an individual bad person, right? Like it's the bad that's happening is much more at a systemic large level versus like a bad seed. I'm sure there's bad seeds, but the numbers and the statistics that I shared could be greatly improved if we were doing more on the front end to support and prevent.
And I think what, you know, to kind of wrap up in a positive message, I think one of the things that is, I mean, our show is thematic of health and wellness, and we talk about diet and lifestyle in a lot of ways. I think, you know, what we're trying to capture is these kids who, you know, can't, you know, don't have access to that sort of next level diet and lifestyle because they don't have their basic needs met. They don't have safety or a feeling of belongingness yet. And so there's an opportunity by supporting the system and advocating for improvements to the system to, you know, really nurture these kids fully.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it was kind of an awakening for me about a year ago. I had someone message me who felt that I had a voice that needed to speak more loudly about these things. And I was like, well, you know, that's just not my lane, like this whole thing. And I remember them saying to me, how can you be worried about people's health from non-toxic living if you're not worried about getting them out of danger and ensuring that they're safe and stable? Because they're never going to get to be able to focus on all the things that we talk about, tweaking lifestyle perspectives, if, you know, there's food insecurity or they don't have a home or they're not safe. And that has become really powerful for me when I think about health and wellness for all, because that's something we've always advocated for here. And while we talk about what you listeners and what we personally experience when it comes to tweaking our own, you know, personal health and wellness, there's a lot more from a broader sense going on in the world that if we really are looking at health, wellness, and safety for all, that we need to take a broader look at. And listen, being a foster parent is not easy, but it is so rewarding, and I'm so glad that we decided to do it and are doing it. And you know, our goal is to hopefully have our current kiddo be a permanent member of our family. That is possible given their current situation, but it's a lot of paperwork and a lot of time. And I have learned so much from them. Like, I am a better person. All of us have become more aware, better people because of the kids that I've had in my home. And these kids deserve to be healthy and well and safe just as much as everybody else.
I think that is the perfect message to wrap up on. So, Stacey, I want to, on behalf of our listeners, thank you for this deep dive. I feel like my head is like buzzing with new information, and I'm going to need like some time to like sit and process and then, you know, for me, it's always like sit, process, and then plan, right? So what are the actions that I can take? And I want to thank you for sharing your expertise about this topic that I feel, isn't certainly in the world that I'm exposed to online, I'm not seeing enough education about this. I feel like I understand the entire system as its strengths as well as its weaknesses so much more now. So thank you so much for that. And to our listeners, thanks for listening. And we'll be back next week.
And we'll be doing the Patreon and what we really thought about it as well. So if you want to hear more about my personal thoughts and experiences, don't forget to join us over on Patreon. Thanks for your patience as I nervously work through these 14 pages of notes here. And we'll be back next week.
Do you love the Whole View podcast? We'd love for you to leave us a review wherever you listen and share a podcast with your friends and family.
And did you know that you can now get exclusive behind-the-scenes content on Patreon for less than the price of an almond milk matcha a month? Your Patreon membership supports us and gets you access to a monthly bonus episode.
But not for kids' ears, because our bonus content is explicit. You can find us as The Whole View on Patreon for our real, unfiltered thoughts on this week's episode.